Welcome back to Mental Health Matters. We got a great show today, and we're so excited to have you on board. This is Mental Health Matters with Dr. Scott Terry. And I am letting you know that if you guys are so interested, this particular Friday the 21st, there's going to be a lecture with our guest today. She's going to give a great talk on living with mental illness, and she'll tell you all about that in a second if you're so interested. If you want to do something like that, go out and have some fun or listen to the recording later, you can certainly do that. And you can listen to our old recordings, including last week's conversation with Kate. Kate Grace is our guest today. You could go to the YouTube channel and go to YouTube and then type in Ardent Counseling Center. Or you can go to our website, which is www.ardentcenter.com. Or you can go to KRUU and look up the archives there. Oh, that should be enough things to do. Anyways, and do email me, Scott at Ardent Center. Ardent is A-R-D-E-N-T, Ardent. Scott at ArdentCenter.com. If you got any questions, show topics, we still have a couple people shows topics that we're going to be doing at some point, living with some other kind of mental illness like borderline personality and a whole bunch of fun stuff. Anyways, so let me introduce our wonderful guest today, Kate Grace. Kate, how are you doing today?
Good, thanks. Yeah, thanks for having me on the show again. I appreciate it.
Oh, you were so fantastic last week. So, Kate, tell us about this program you're going to be doing if people are remotely interested or want to listen to the program later, because we're going to try and record it and archive it.
The program today is about, I wrote a book called Collateral Damage, The Impact of My Mother's Mental Illness on Me.
Okay, what was that again? That kind of fuzzed out. Collateral Damage.
Collateral Damage, The Impact of My Mother's Mental Illness on Me.
Cool, okay.
Yeah, and so there's several different sort of topics to the book. It's a fast read, short chapters, but one of the topics that I find really interesting in light of some other things is, I think what I call it, a preference for chaos. When you have a childhood like I had, you have a preference for chaos.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, it's true, because you almost get addicted to chaos, and, you know, it becomes, you know, what it was like you're used to, but it becomes the go-to of what your brain actually wants. It doesn't feel settled in a strange way unless there's craziness going on.
Yeah, exactly. And so I thought probably the best way for me to illustrate would be to read that chapter.
Okay.
I'll just give a bit of a backdrop. So my mother was very acutely unwell, so it caused her to be abusive to me and to be neglectful of me. I'm the oldest of three sisters, and I had an older brother. So I was also parentified at a very young age, which I grew up in the 60s and 70s. So a lot of people my age would say that they did a lot of took on a parental role. I think the unusual part for me was it was quite an extensive parental role that I took on at a very young age. My mother was very unpredictable, so I had a childhood which I would describe as chaotic and fearful, a lot of unpredictability and a degree of hopelessness as well. The reason I wrote the book is I think children are in a different situation than an adult who's dealing with that, because children really don't have any power. So I'll read this chapter because when I wrote it, I had some aha moments, and hopefully people listening to it will as well.
Yeah, I think that sounds great. And so this chapter is dealing with chaos, or how would you well, you'll be reading this in a second, but
yeah.
Just so people have a bit clearer background, your mother's mental illness, you said before that she was psychotic and she was schizophrenic of some type.
Yes.
And so you never knew as a child who you were coming home to.
Yeah. And sometimes I wouldn't know if when I walked from one room to the next, who was going to be, that it would happen that quickly.
Right, so it's not like living with an alcoholic parent where you're living with Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, so to speak, unless they're the angry drunk all the time. You're when they're drinking, you know that they're a certain person, and when they're not drinking, they're a different person.
Right.
But for her, literally, you're saying you walk in the other room, she could get triggered because the sun came out. She could get triggered because, you know, the TV was on, there was a fly in the room, it could have been anything. It didn't really matter.
But when you're a child, Scott, what I think, at least what I thought was, I thought I was triggering her, you see.
Yeah, because you internalize it and you think it's all about you.
Yeah.
And that's part of that parentification. So it's not only taking ownership of the family, but you then adopt her reality as your reality, and you don't know who you are.
Yeah, true. Well said. You should write a book, Scott.
With your help, we will.
Awesome. I'm up for that.
Yeah, well, you got this one down. Maybe the next one me and you will do.
There you go.
All right. So read us a little bit about this, and then just read a couple pages, and then so that we can interact a little bit on this, because I'm really excited to actually hear your words.
Okay. All of us had our own reaction to what was going on around us. We all had our own complex systems of survival. My brother John is nearly 3 years older than me. I'm the second oldest, then follows my sister Joan. I'm 4 years older than Rose and 8 years older than Sue. John was rarely disciplined by my mother. He was not around the rest of us that often, working outside with my father or in his bedroom listening to music. John removed himself from the situation, from all of us, every opportunity he had. He shut down from us, from the situation. As the oldest of my sisters, I felt very protective of them. Some of that arose naturally from my role as their big sister. That was enhanced by me taking care of them as a mother would, because their mother was not always able to do so. I felt a responsibility to keep them safe and to help make their way in a world, in a home, that seemed too harsh for children. I felt better equipped to survive than I thought them to be. By virtue of my age, I had an enormous advantage over my two youngest sisters, Rose and Sue. Joan, sensitive and sweet, felt everything acutely and wrestled with her pain. Her struggles knocked her off balance and affected her ability to function. Not me. I managed to channel the pain that accompanied the chaos into creative outlets. I played the piano, wrote poems and stories, daydreamed. I studied hard and excelled at school. In some respects, I appeared to thrive. Having always excelled at anything I put my mind to, I put my mind to our survival. A good thing when you need to be in survival mode. But the funny thing is that my mind, so accustomed to the struggle to survive, did not know when to stop being in survival mode.
Mm.
Even when I was long gone from my childhood home and that need to struggle to survive, I didn't seem to be fully alive unless I could continue to do what it seemed I did best. I was more comfortable in the chaos than the calm. I understood chaos. I knew the rules. I had an important part to play, I knew and understood, and at which I had become very adept. I had a sense of anxiety unless I had just finished dealing with chaos, was in the midst of chaos, pending. I did not keep calm. It did not feel real to me. That it was only a matter of time before the calm would end. I did not want to become relaxed into it. Understand the rules of my world. Foreign country with strange customs and a language I did not understand. This had an enormous impact on my adult life. I created chaos with was none, threw problems up in front of myself, sabotaged the seemingly natural course of my life so that I could continue to play out what I had known and learned so well as a child. These were good transferable skills, and I used them to become a very good lawyer. I became skilled at quick, creative, lateral thinking outside the box. My need for unrest led to what felt to me like exciting, demanding places. A career where I had to simultaneously solve and create problems, where I had to think quickly on my feet, and in the midst of those storms appear cool and calm, able to rationalize and persuade. It led me to a marriage to a wonderful man with multiple addictions. I looked for conflict in my personal relationships, pushing on potential weak spots until they erupted. Over and over again, when my life became quiet, I purposely stirred it up. It made me feel alive, fulfilled. It made me feel normal. So there's more, but I thought if you want to stop there.
No, I mean, that's great. And I think it's so true how it becomes a maladaptive coping mechanism. So a maladaptive coping mechanism we describe as, let me give a terrible example, where somebody's raped and they sit there and say, I don't want to be attractive to the opposite sex anymore. I don't want to be attractive to myself anymore. I'm afraid of my sexuality, of even being in my body. And so I will become an emotional eater and I will gain 100 pounds. And now I've got the secondary problem, which is now I'm killing myself. I've taken somebody else, what they did to me, and integrated that into who I am, and I'm now destroying me. anger turned inward, as Freud said, is depression. But also that notion of chaos you describe is indicative of a number of conditions that we see, from borderline personality disorder to people that are simply have ADHD, where the drug of choice, as I say, for someone with ADHD is stimulation, just wanting stimulation. So you see little kids creating fights just because they don't want to be bored. They'd rather be punished than be bored. And so finding out another way to stimulate yourself in a healthy way, or how to accept that you don't need chaos and could accept having some peace in your brain. You know, it's a fascinating concept to play with.
Yes. I mean, finally, with me, I just became physically unwell. And I had one stress-related disorder after another. And I kept refusing to believe that perhaps I had something to do with it. But I finally just realized if I didn't deal with it, I wasn't probably going to make it. I probably wasn't going to live. You know what I mean? Like, it was breaking me down inside of myself. So I just decided, you know, I'm going to have to learn how to be calm and live with the calm and be okay with the calm.
Yeah, and it's crazy in a weird way that how do I accept calm, normal, peace? Like, I'm so used to war and the screaming and the pain and the upset and the drama seeking, you know? It's not enough for you to rescue your brothers. You now have to create somebody else in your life to rescue. And so you become codependent. And so I applaud your healthiness in not only getting it intellectually, which really doesn't matter, but the doing something about it, which does.
Yeah, and like I when somebody told me, and I write about it in the book, but I won't read that part, but when a friend of mine told me that I was the one that was causing my chaos, that I was the architect of my chaotic life, I was so angry.
And
inside myself, I knew he was spot on, but I couldn't believe it. Like, I was, and for me, identifying that was the way forward. I didn't know what I didn't know. I had no idea that I was doing it.
I love when people say that. I didn't know what I didn't know.
No, I had no idea.
But
it made sense. You know what I mean? I knew he was right.
But, you know, again, as a lesson to others, what you did, which was so powerful, and I really so applaud you for, wasn't just intellectually getting it. You're obviously an intelligent, vital person, but it wasn't just an intellectual or even an emotional getting it, so to speak. It's the, I'm going to do something about it and make a difference.
Yeah.
And, for instance, you're writing this book, I'm sure, is also part of that journey to make a difference for others. Like we talk about volunteerism. Well, you're directly making a difference for others. You're getting that word out to say it's time you to be empowered yourself, to stop living in that past and to create a new future today.
Right. And maybe somebody would read that chapter and say, oh, my God, that's me. I didn't realize
Me
as well. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. And you're the one who inspired that. And that's so powerful. So
there's a documentary called Paper Tigers. Have you heard of it?
No, tell me about it.
Okay, so and the reason I bring it up is because it just flows nicely into all this. So Paper Tigers is a documentary about the school in Walla Walla, Washington, where it was an alternative school, terrible outcomes, lots of truancy, violence, you know, assault, low graduation rate, very virtually no postgraduate training or education. And the principal went to a training session and learned about adverse childhood experiences. So I don't know if you heard of ACE, adverse childhood experiences. It's a way to quantify childhood trauma on a scale of 1 to 10. And you can do the quiz online. It's basically 10 questions.
And it's ACE is the program, ACE, by the way, for people who are listening.
Experiences, yeah. And so the higher your score, the more a chance that you're going to have health issues as an adult. And anything over a score of 4 is a high score. Well, my score, I did mine, and you can go on and do it. Mine was 6. So 6 out of 10 isn't very good. But what this principal did was he came back and he said, these stressed kids who score high on this ACE quantifiable childhood trauma scoring tool can't learn because they're so stressed out. And what got me, I watched the film. It was really good. You can download it from Amazon for stream it from Amazon for like $4. Mm. But it was how the children came to school and that desire for chaos because they understood it. And the weird thing, if you think about it, is in times of stress, we want to go back to where we're comfortable. Well, if what we're comfortable with is stress, then we're going to do stressful things to get us back into where we're comfortable. It's just a vicious cycle, and that's what was going on with these children. And it was normal for them.
Yeah, absolutely. By the way, you're listening to Mental Health Matters with Dr. Scott Terry. And today, we are talking once again to Kate Grace, our second in our series. And hopefully, we'll have many more because Kate is so wonderful.
Oh, thanks, Scott.
Oh, she is. And we're talking about her book, Collateral Damage. And by the way, the talk she's going to be doing this Friday, if people are interested, Friday the 21st. So if you're listening months from now, well, you'll have to download it on the Arden Counseling Center's YouTube channel or Arden Center's website. But the talk is really fascinating because right now we're talking about how you actually adapt to thinking it's normal. And even when you think this is not normal, and that's why I said the action part is so essential. It's not just enough to sort of intellectually go, but this isn't normal. You have to go beyond thought and you have to go beyond just feeling, oh, well, this doesn't feel right, and do something to make it, to shift it.
Yeah.
And that's where your power and control comes back to you again. And, you know, one little anecdote I could add to what you were saying, and then I'll shift it back to you here, is I did, in Iowa, it's called DHS, and in Illinois, it's called DCFS, Department of Child and Family Services. And I work with them with abused children for about 18 years of my 25 years I've been doing this. And one of the things I found so fascinating is I'd work with these families of post-adoption children. So they'd have adopted these children even at a fairly young age, and you could have been healthy parents. But since the child was so used to chaos, they would replicate that chaos even in a healthy environment because that's what they were used to. And I'm telling you, we're conditioned like we are rats. And that's, we get used to a certain thing and we can't break that unless we really do something to break that pattern.
That's so interesting. And it makes such sense to me, especially children, because we're like little blank canvases when we're kids, you know?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, the brain, the way it works in the brain is there's like a groove in there. You develop a certain pathway in the brain and it becomes fixed unless you actually do something to change it, which is why, you know, action, doing something, creating something. Yes, you have to acknowledge whatever happened. Yes, you have to experience what you're experiencing without judgment, shame, guilt, remorse, judgment, all that kind of stuff, letting it go. Yes, you need to understand it. Yes, you need to feel it. But in the end, you need to create a new reality. You need to do something with it and create your power and control back to you again so you can make a difference in the lives of others as you make a difference in the life of yourself.
Well said. Exactly right. That's my experience.
Okay, enough of my diatribe here. Go back to your thing. Tell us more about what the experience was that you're trying to get to for other people to understand.
Okay. Well, I just want to talk about, I guess, the other ways that sort of desire for chaos can manifest. In me, it was this overachieving, you know, pushing on relationships kinds of things. But, I mean,
well, not just in relationships, in, you know, becoming an attorney as you did, and a very successful one from the sounds of it, you know, you have to become a little type A and like really push.
Yeah, I was totally a type A.
Yes.
So the stress seeking that can also manifest is like, and this is what I was looking at in the movie and what I've also observed around me is like not showing up on time for appointments or just not showing up for things. having trouble getting things done, chronically late for work, having chronic unemployment issues, being in a pattern of bad relationships, not paying your bills on time. So I call that the infrastructure of your life. Or I think when people are stuck in that ACE, that high ACE, I need stress cycle, they're doing those kinds of things. So people would understand, kind of like when the guy told me, and I was so angry. But it's not just, you know, overachieving. It's also sort of underachieving and not maintaining your own infrastructure well.
Right, and then having to cover up all the time that underachieving and masking it with overachieving on the other side. And so it's like this always this cover-up game. I'm not as dumb as I, you know, could appear to, and I can't have any failings, and I need people to like me, or I need people to see that I'm a success, or I need, instead of being, again, that peace, that calm, and just being who you need to be for yourself.
So, I mean, I think when you have a high ACE, and I would say a lot of people with a childhood, with a parent with severe mental illness would probably have an high average child experiences score.
Yeah.
I think breaking that cycle is one of the hardest things to do. Admitting that that's happening, that they're purposely the architect of their own difficult life, and then breaking that. Yeah. I did it with yoga, and I did it with becoming sort of meditative about things. And
excellent.
Trying to let things go and calming down. And I used to be very impatient, and I still feel impatient, but I don't act impatient as much as I did. So it's just being more aware of yourself, I think. And that's not, when you have a traumatic childhood, that's not always easy because it's painful. But I guess if people are listening and they have that childhood, I would say it's just worth it. Just go for it, man. It's worth it to try to get to the other side of that and to not have all that stress and chaos in your life. It's really hard. It's really hard on you.
And you really can heal from the PTSD. You really can heal from the traumas in our lives. And, you know, that's what's so remarkable about it. We might have patterns that we're used to, and we're so comfortable with our patterns that we think we can't change them, or we think that's normal. But you can.
Yeah.
And there are a better way to live. And you, again, had that awakening. And you did something.
I didn't think I'd make it if I kept going the way I was.
No, absolutely. So why don't you read it to us another minute or so, if you find another passage in there that you think would be illuminating.
You fill for a second and I'll find some.
All right. Well, I mean, I think what you're talking about is so remarkable. Again, it's the, we experience something, and it's that awakening moment that we all have in our lives, but we have to allow ourselves to actually, like I said, not just have that moment, but to do something with that moment. That's really our power. That's who we are. And whatever tools work for you to do it, you use the whole bag of tools. You meditate, you exercise every day. You change your nutrition habits so you're eating healthy, so your gut bacteria and, you know, the microbes in your stomach, you know, you produce more serotonin in your stomach than in your head, and using your nutrition as a way to reorientate. You make sure that you're getting the proper sleep, you know, that 7.5 to 9 hours a night. You do whatever tools you need, and you do them all, and you get, I'm going to do what's right, and I'm going to stop running away and doing what's hurting me or hurting others, because it's not about who we were and what we've done, but it's about what we're going to create next. Okay, enough of me now. You ready?
I'm going to read a little poem that I wrote at the very beginning of the book, because I think it's illuminating about, and again, I hope it'll resonate with people.
Sounds good.
She stays there in the corner, little girl lost, thrown away, not good enough, discarded. As real as the air I breathe, as much a part of me as my fingers. I keep her away from me, around her, this core of me. I have constructed walls spun from confidence, a sense of belonging. Not raw materials, but manufactured. Not to keep her away from me, but to keep me away from her. She dictates that I will always be, at most, a happy, sad person. But I am content with that. Two steps forward, one step back. Sometimes one step forward and two steps back. half-truths around which I spin my speculation, malevolent motivations dressed in counterfeit clothes, lost, thrown away, not good enough. So begins the erosion of my sense of myself. The wall, so carefully constructed, not so sturdy after all, cracks appear, then gaping holes. The dust of my confidence settles around that wreckage, and there she is, and there I am.
Wow. Very powerful.
That's how I felt, and I still do feel, I guess, to be honest, emerging from that childhood. And so it is two steps forward, one step back, but mostly I'm going forward, and I guess that's my message of hope for people who had a rough childhood or a childhood like mine, or if you're in one now with a parent like that.
Yeah.
Got to keep going.
Whatever, wherever you're at. And for some of us, it's two steps back and one step forward. But
yeah.
It's the doing. It's the keep stepping. It's you get off the horse and you get back on again. You fall off the bike and you get back on. And you do something to make...
And you seek out help. Like, you know, you offer help. I think you have to go find help. I don't think you can do it by yourself. It's hard to do it by yourself.
Right, because you can't see outside your own skin.
Yeah.
You know, none of us can. I can't. I've been doing this a long time, and I can't see outside my own skin. And I get trapped in anger and frustration and fights, and, you know, I'm human.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, we all need help. That's the thing about this. None of us are alone. None of us could live alone. We all create power. So, thank you so much. And, you know, it's really interesting how we all process trauma. There's so many examples. And let me just give a pitch to a movie that I just saw in Iowa City at Film Scene the other week. It was called My Name is Ove, O-V-E, I believe. And it was a Swedish film. And it talks, and it's this beautiful film. I highly recommend it. But I know I'm not supposed to promote it, and I'm not promoting it because it's probably gone by the time people are hearing this. But what was cool about it is how you could deal with pain and trauma and stress and want to hurt yourself and then say, no, I want life to get better. And that's all any of us need to decide now, is to make that step forward.
Yep. That's the hard part.
So, Kate, once again, for the last time, this Friday, the 21st, that's October 21st, if you're listening at a different time, sorry, you could look it up on our YouTube channel at Arden Center, Arden Counseling Center on YouTube. But if not, come on down if you feel like it. And hear Kate.
At the Fairfield Public Library at 7 p.m.
Yes, I think it's actually starting at 8 o'clock, but doors will open at 7 to have they can meet you beforehand. Is that not true?
Cool, that's perfect.
All right. Well, thank you, Kate, and I look forward to doing many more shows with you. Is there any last words you'd like to say of wisdom before we close out?
Oh, gosh, I'm so wise. So very, very wise. No.
Yes, you are.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity. I'm so happy we're talking about this.
Yeah, well, I'm so happy that you're, again, not just wrote this, but want to make a difference. You're not going to get rich on a book. You're already doing what you need to be doing in your life, your dharma, your purpose. But
yeah.
this is the way to give back and to make a difference in others' people's lives. And it means being vulnerable and open and sharing. And I so applaud you for doing that. And I applaud all of us for sharing and being open, because we're stronger by being vulnerable. Real men do cry, and real women are who they need to be, and they're not subjected to anybody for any reason. And so being human means being vulnerable and finding your strength of core and purpose within you. Thank you, Kate. Have a great day. Bye.